Thank you very much, Tanya. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's CCI call on Tuesday, the 1st of May. We have Cheryl Langdon-Orr, Tobias Mahler, Olivier Crétin-Leblond, Steve Del Bianco, Michael Graham, Jonathan Zook. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Julie Headland, and myself, Gisela Gruber. Apology to note today noted from John Berard. I don't think I've left anyone off the list. And if I could please also remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Barry.
Great. Thank you, Gisela. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce Michael Graham to the working group. He'll be submitting his SOI here in the next day or so. Correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but I believe you've been following the efforts of the Consumer Metrics Working Group and decided to start participating here shortly. And so we welcome you and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, that is correct. I actually started following it at the behest of the Internet subcommittee of the International Trademark Association during the Costa Rican meeting, and happened to be on the ground and was able to benefit from the various presentations and meetings there, and came back and worked with the INTA in preparing our comments on the draft advisory. So I'm glad to be a member of the working group. I hope I can add some insight going forward.
Welcome.
Great. Michael, this is Steve Del Bianco. Thanks for what are definitely the most substantive and detailed comments thus far on our draft advice. And if the agenda accommodates it, it might be great to drill into that, into advice, to see if you can answer some questions a few of us have about some of your ideas, okay?
Certainly. I can try or take those back and get the answers for you, yeah.
Great. Back to you, Barry.
Great. And just to bring you up to speed, basically, Michael, where we're at, we're reviewing through some of the comments that we'll receive in Costa Rica. And in our next session on the 15th, we'll be reviewing a summary analysis of the public comments submitted and any replies that are produced. We'll basically be incorporating those comments and apply those comments where agreed upon for making changes to the draft advice letter. And then from there, once we've completed the final version, we'll be submitting it over to the GNSO Council for their consideration. So, again, welcome. We're basically in wrap-up mode for the most part, but we're glad that you're joining. So from that perspective, we have a pretty light agenda so far today, and that, as I mentioned, just to continue on with the comments from the Costa Rica session. We have about 70 minutes allotted to that, and I'll just run through the action items real quick, and then we'll move over into the comments. Basically, from our last session, there was discussion about reaching out to government contacts with respect to the consumer metrics and report back to the working group of any ongoings further in detail. Steve was going to try to reach out to Heather about a webinar for the GAC, and if they were interested in that. Does anybody have any comments with respect to those two?
This is Steve. No replies from Heather or from Bruce Tonkin yet, which is the next item on there.
Great. And then the last one, which is for Rosemary. And I'm not sure if I caught the name correctly or not. I mentioned to collaborate with Richard. Is that correct that he's the Australia GAC representative?
Well, it's not Richard, but yeah, it's Peter Nettlefold.
Do you recall? I think I remember Rosemary saying a Richard, but I don't.
Peter Nettlefold, Rosemary, and I had a conference call with half a dozen of the Department of Broadband Communication Digital Economy staff that he works with scheduled. I wasn't able to attend the call, but Rosemary and Peter did go ahead with it, and as far as I know, it went very well as a briefing.
And is his last name spelled N-E-T?
Nettlefold. Nettle, as in the herb, fold, F-O-L-D.
Great. Thank you.
No problem.
And so lastly, I think we'll go ahead and get started with continuing on with the comments. And if I recall correctly, we stopped at the consumer section of the document that you see posted within the Adobe Connect session. So, Steve, why don't I hand it over to you?
Thanks, Barry. And I see you're displaying the staff's summary of the comments that occurred at the Costa Rica meeting in the public 90-minute workshop. Michael Graham, and those of you who are not on Adobe, you have access to Barry Cobb's, the Word doc that he has. It won't be constructive for you without seeing an outline of those comments. Does anyone need a copy?
Michael, I'll send one to you right now.
Anyone else before Barry hits the send button?
Hold on.
Fabulous. So while those come through, Barry did a great job. It's a two-page summary. Now, behind that is an entire transcript of the 90 minutes. So from time to time, we consulted that transcript. To get to that transcript, I'll get somebody to put a hyperlink in the chat window. But it's accessible for those of you who are not in Adobe. You'll want to go to the actual Costa Rica schedule, to the Wednesday morning Consumer Metrics workshop. And you'll see under documents there will be a transcript of the meeting, and that may be helpful to understand because staff has summarized what was said in Costa Rica. Now, given the time allotted here, it would be my guess that we got halfway through Costa Rica comments last time, but let's not use all of this time for that. Given that we have INTA on the line, I think it would be constructive to divide our time between the Costa Rica comment discussion and then asking INTA for some details and clarifications on their comments. Any agreement or disagreement with that in terms of an agenda? All right, good. I see one yes, so we'll go with that. So as Barry said, we made it through Consumer Trust, and we were just on the word consumer. But Barry's got it right in the middle of the screen. And we had a comment in Costa Rica where they wanted us to distinguish between consumer registrants versus professional registrants. And what is everyone's recall of that? There was a distinction they felt was important for the purposes of determining consumer, because we said we don't make any such distinction in our definition. Consumers are our actual potential users and registrants. Whether that user is paid to do it, that's professional, or doing it out of their own volition, we didn't believe was important. So I'm going to turn to the transcript. Thanks, Barry, for putting that link up.
And this is Barry. Just to add to that, these two comments that are listed under the consumer definition, both of these were received through the Adobe Connect session. And as you'll find out in the transcript, the GPM group asked their specific question, and Steve responded with a well-thought-out answer, which is yes. So
it worked for me, too, Steve.
But the second question did come from Rudy Vansnick, and we said that we would get back to him, so I'm hoping that we can try to come up with an answer, and I'll email him off list to see if that suffices. And I just lost network connectivity, so I may be in and out of the Adobe Connect session throughout this session.
Does that mean you'll have a problem scrolling through our document?
Possibly.
When you get back on, can you give us the... thank you. Someone's given us individual control. Thanks. That's probably Geezer if you weren't on, Barry. Thanks. Julie can take control as well. Oh, we've got plenty of controllers. That was Cheryl for the transcript record. So, sorry, Steve, do you want us to respond now to the consumer versus professional registrants, or was your yes?
It is, Cheryl. We'd like to hear whether anybody here believes that we need, anyone in the working group believes that we need to draw that distinction in any way by changing our definition, or perhaps even indicating in the notes of our advice that we mean both.
Okay, Cheryl, for the transcript record then, I don't think we need to change our definition, but we may, in fact, with this need a footnote or a discussion point somewhere in the text. You see, I'm immediately challenged even just by this language, a consumer registrant versus a professional registrant. Where does one even draw the line between what makes a professional registrant? If I happen to run a portfolio of some 20 names, which are for my clients, and I get some form of remuneration or reward for doing that, for example, their continued contractual relationship with me, for example, does that make me a professional registrant? Versus, you know, I own 5,475 million of them. Now, that will make an effect on our metrics, and we may need to be able to differentiate somewhere in the measures, but I don't think it should make much of a difference beyond recognising that there is a scale in the definition. But then I'm open to be convinced otherwise as well.
Cheryl, thanks very much. I just did go to the transcript, page 24, and when Barry read us the question, they asked us, GPM Group said, that the consumer definition didn't distinguish between professional and consumer. Whereas professional registrants are making registrations in the course of a business, and in many jurisdictions, they wouldn't be considered consumers per se. So I think it was more of a legalistic question, that a professional registrant or a professional user, would they still be considered in our definition of consumers? Now, as Barry indicated, we gave what Barry thought was a great answer, and it was a one-word answer. I said, yes. Yes,
exactly.
They are. They're all in there. And
yes.
If we're all good with that, then we've answered that question. And at the most, our advice would contain a footnote that it doesn't really matter whether the entity is a professional or an individual. It's about
or under what jurisdiction, what definitional jurisdiction, et cetera, et cetera.
And on the definition of consumer, Cheryl, I think it was you who wanted, and you and Olivier, where we pressed on the notion of a consumer. This is the top page 4 in our draft advice. And we said that the definition focuses not on the nature of the entity, but rather on the role they're playing by using the DNS to do resolutions or to register a domain name. Therefore, any entity can be regarded as a consumer, including individuals, businesses, governments, nonprofits, et cetera.
The whole damn lot. Yep.
Gosh, I really think that our existing advice is sufficient, and we probably don't need to do anything on this comment.
Wouldn't mind... If you wanted to put a footnote in it saying we recognise the scale because it has been raised in the questions.
Now, the question didn't actually go to scale. It simply went to the word consumer being applied to an entity that was really a professional.
Sorry.
They didn't ask about scale. You raised an interesting point about scale, Cheryl.
Okay.
But it wasn't part of this question that came about in Costa Rica.
It might have come at me from... Olivier, I think that might have been raised in our ALAC and at large discussion. Then I might be.
Well, then please elaborate so I understand precisely how.
Well, I would think add there was the issues of how. Well, as you know, we have some amongst the at large community who also see the necessity, as we have obviously got in our definition, to not actually just be registrant, but to simply be consuming the end product of the resolution. So we've got all that sorted. But there is also the matter of whether or not large-scale registrants are, in fact, more on the industry side of the spectrum than they are on the end-user side of the spectrum. My personal view, and the view that I've pushed in the CCTLD that I have a management interest in, is that domainers belong on the end-user demand side, and they're just on a different scale. So it might have been I was answering that in that presentation and have linked it in with this, which I shouldn't have done, so I shall hide now and have another...
Oh, don't ever hide, Cheryl. You can't do that. Well, I just re-scanned the ALAC comments, and you're right, they're not mentioned in there. It's more along the lines of the definition of the entity and the role they play.
Yeah.
So Barry raised an interesting question in the chat, because none of our metrics are counting consumers. We simply say that people playing the role of consumer as a registrant or a user, it's their activities that we track. So whether they are professional or individual, their activities are counted the same.
And I would argue, Cheryl, again, for the transcript record, I would argue that unless one needs to differentiate between a single or small group interest registrant and a commercially interested registrant, all of which are still consumers, unless there's a drive to do that, which I don't see in our either the resolution or in the affirmation of commitments, the measurement of how the consumer trust, et cetera, goes with the new GTLDs, I don't think we need to differentiate. But if we did, we'd have to do it in the metrics, not the definitions.
All right. Any further discussion on the GPM comment? Let's move to the next one. It was Rudy Vansnick,
mm-hmm.
and their question was that, let me read from the transcript just a tiny bit clearer. He said, trust is a very flexible word, and several definitions can be attributed. But at the end, what does a consumer get in return if they trust the other party? I suggest that you look at how registrants are handled by registrars, and do they need different types of trust? And we answered to Mr. Rudy, we said we'll take that on board and try to parse it a little bit later, and that probably would be now. How does one parse that and figure out what precisely they're after?
Steve, this is Barry. I'd just like to add to this that I mistakenly threw this under the summary section of consumer, but this was really asked within the greater discussion of consumer trust. So, of course, they kind of go hand in hand.
Thank you. So from our advice, when we talked about trust, if you remember, our definition had to do with confidence.
Yep.
Confidence about that the DNS would work reliably and that when we visited a GTLD that ended in something .bank or a GTLD that implied a certain promise, either explicitly or implicitly, how much confidence did we have that the promise would be kept. And we also suggested that it was trust that if I visit a domain in .bank, would it be complying with ICANN policies and applicable national laws? If I visited .poker, for instance, and I'm a U.S. resident, would I have confidence that poker was adhering to U.S. law for me, a U.S. user? This is way outside of ICANN's scope, per se, but it all gets to notions of trust. In Rudy's question, he asks, look at how the registrant is handled by the registrar.
But that's apples and oranges.
Say it again, please.
That's apples and oranges.
Yeah, I know, because the registrant is handled by the registrar only at the time they're getting a domain name or maybe reassigning their name server or renewing. So
sure,
maybe they're getting at the notion of our registrants, forgetting end users for a minute, but our registrants handled by registrar in a way that fosters trust. Did we have any metrics that got to the notion of registrants trusting in registrars? For instance, complaints? Barry and the rest of you from staff, if registrants are unhappy with how they're handled by a registrar, how does that register in the compliance regime at ICANN?
Depends if it's a compliance issue.
This is Barry. Certainly, if the registrant knew of the ICANN complaint system, they might submit a complaint via that route. I'm unsure of how compliance would act upon that. But another tangent could be is, you know, transfers as well. And I'm not saying that this is all inclusive, but the whole reason for inter-registrar transfer policy is that if I no longer enjoyed the services from Registrar A, I can easily transfer my domains to the better class provider, Registrar B. But, you know, sorting through those kinds of metrics may be quite difficult to understand or distinguish which ones are due to a lack of trust from the original registrar.
Do we have, would you explain again, so ICANN maintains a complaint system that is completely generic. Anybody who wants to complain about anything can put it in. And is there a way to categorize Sorry, Gisela, this is Steve Del Bianco. Is there a way to categorize if there are complaints about how they were handled by a registrar? Anyone on staff help us with that answer?
This is Barry. I can review through the system. Off the top of my head, I don't believe that there's a specific category for that type of complaint. Usually it would probably fall under transfers or one of the other types of complaints that ICANN does handle. But I'll look into that and get back to the working group.
None of our consumer trust metrics are looking at the quantity or seriousness of these generic complaints. We have several that have the word complaints, but they're associated with UDRP, URS complaints, and RRDRP complaints. We do not have a general category of the complaint box for ICANN. And if there is such a thing, and Barry can discover if it's categorizable,
well,
then maybe we do have a metric.
Steve, this is Jonathan Zook. Can you hear me?
Yes,
yeah,
John.
Please go ahead.
Oh, yes. The current system is based on specific complaint categories. As Barry said, such as a transfer complaint. And so it's very likely that a report could be generated based on what subset of those complaints could be considered registrar-oriented complaints, even under the current system. But that said, the entire system is going under a complete overhaul as we speak, and more sophisticated ticket management systems, et cetera, are being assessed. So I think we ought to take a more greenfield approach to this and present these as requirements to the compliance team rather than simply limiting to ourselves to the system that's currently in place. But I would argue that even the system as it currently stands has a set of categories, and the subset of those categories are in fact attributable to registrars, for example. But I think a more sophisticated system is in the offing already, and we should just get our requirements in part of that requirements assessment that they're doing.
Thanks, hey, Jonathan. Cheryl, your hand's up.
Thank you, Cheryl, for the transcript record. Two things. First of all, I just wanted to mention to Barry that I think the Ombudsman also has an early filter in his complaint system, which would be picking up some complaints about registrars. Now, he doesn't deal with those, but I know it's a filter that's applied early in the system, so that might be a metric that we could have access to, so sort of ask him as well. I'm sure Chris will be happy to play. And the second point, following on from what Jonathan just said, I think it could be really useful if there's a rejigging of how the ticketing and the nomenclature and everything is. I wonder if at a not too distant future we might get a little briefing about what types of changes and metrics are possible that we weren't aware of in the existing system, what might be planned, because it might be handy for us to know before we do our final recommendation.
I guess I'm, Cheryl, this is Jonathan Zook again. I guess I'm suggesting that those plans are in their early stages now. So more than a review of what's possible, I think we ought to be assertive in making requests.
Yeah.
And then with few exceptions, maybe being told that some of them are not possible. But that requirements analysis is happening right now in real time. So we ought to try to assert ourselves into it would be my suggestion.
So,
Cheryl,
Jonathan, this is Steve. So, we might ask them that the fields that are captured with respect to a complaint would indicate things like the role the complainer was playing. Were they a registrant or a user?
Exactly.
What
right.
contract party were they dealing with, registrar or registry? Might ask them what was the nature of their operation, registration, or a transfer. And those three questions I just asked, if those were the ways they categorized complaints, it would get to this particular comment from Rudy Vansnick. We also might have to ask them, though, which TLD was your complaint in regard
yes.
to, i.e., was it a new or an old? We'd figure that out later, but we would ask them which TLD.
Well, there's already a field in the complaint system for the domain. Deriving the TLD from that wouldn't be very difficult.
Great. Now, if we did that prospectively, assuming they get this done in the next year, you would be able to measure, say, the quantity of complaints or the seriousness of complaints of new versus legacy TLDs, but you would not be able to track back against history since this categorization didn't occur with complaints that have been captured thus far in time. Is that correct?
Well, again, I believe that, again, this is Jonathan Zook, and Barry may know more, but, I mean, there are existing categorizations in the complaint system. What the system is currently missing is any steps after the initial complaint. Mm. So all that can really be tracked into the past are the initiations of complaints, if you will, and not their resolutions. But at the initiation level, there is a drop-down box that suggests what are you complaining about and what is the relevant domain name, and there's some information about you. So, I mean, there might be some historical information that by applying some categorization to the existing complaint categories that we could derive whether these are registrar complaints versus registry complaints, et cetera. And the current complaint ticketing system does accept complaints that are outside the purview of the compliance system currently, but again might be useful for data purposes in terms of assessing trust.
And you did say that while you could back categorize the role, contract party, operation, and domain name, you don't think that the existing database captures the resolution of a complaint.
I know that it does not. The existing database is only the initiation of a complaint.
All right.
The rest is all manual under the current system.
Got it. So, Barry, may I ask your assistance with you and staff? Let's capture that we ought to consider adding at least a new measure under consumer trust, gets at the notion of complaints about registrar handling of registrations and transfers in the new GTLD space versus legacy GTLDs. The source would be ICANN's complaints database. And the difficulties are probably none noted as of yet. But somewhere in the notes, we have to indicate it's mostly a comparison between legacy and new GTLDs. It won't be as easy to compare resolved complaints in the past because that data will not be available. Jonathan, finally, do you have any insights about timing on the determination of the new complaint system?
They are pretty cagey about ultimate timing, but they're in the middle of evaluation of two more sophisticated ticketing systems, full-blown ticketing systems that would track through to resolution as we speak, and expect to have the results of those studies within about a month, and then there would need to be some installation of the system, et cetera. But I think, you know, I think realistically it's probably 6 months or something before they have a new system in place.
I guess that wouldn't discourage us from putting the metric in here.
I think that's right, and I think we should be making requests for specific types of to be captured in the first place, and it could be, you know, taken for what it's worth at the point at which it's evaluated. You know, it might not be enough data to be statistically significant, but it still will be interesting. Totally.
Yeah, Barry's noting we don't have a compliance team member on the call today, but Barry, I appreciate your help at reaching out to them. Find that Rudy had asked us about complaints about registrars, but registrars sell names that are both legacy and new, and if a registrar is sloppy in handling transfers, I wonder whether it makes a difference whether it's a new GTLD or a legacy GTLD.
Probably not.
You know, it may not, right, Cheryl? But we'll wait and see, and all we can do is suggest that this is a metric, and it makes sense to do that. Any other comments on that item from Costa Rica?
I guess the other issue is whether or not we're focusing on registrars, but it could very well be that part of what we want to do is ensure that registries are part of the complaint system going forward. Some interest has already been expressed about that. And so, you know, under the new GTLD system, there might be a different set of categories of complaints that aren't even currently captured that have to do with registries. And in that context, the distinction between new and old TLDs would become significant.
That's a great point. So let's have at least two rows, right? One row would be measuring the incidence of complaints about registrars' handlings and another about registries. And we did say that the data fields in the complaint system would include the contract party they were dealing with.
That's right.
That would allow us to distinguish.
Cheryl here, Steve.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Thanks, Cheryl, for the transcript record. A couple of things. First of all, I like where this conversation and the metrics concept and adding it in and sounds like a bit of serendipity in terms of good timing, which is great. I want to wonder, though, can perhaps it be of value, Barry, if more than just having a compliance member on the next call and an interaction from our questions today, I'm wondering if we might not need a very much a single-purpose discussion with compliance at whatever level it takes, about getting them to look at our current metrics, our aspirational metrics, and making sure they understand what we're on about and we understand what the possibilities are before we close off on this report and final recommendations. It seems like an opportunity too good to miss. Second to that, coming back specifically to Rudy's question, I think in terms of response to Rudy's question, Steve, I'd like to suggest that what the consumer gets in return, if he or she trusts the other party, that part of the question, will be a surety under our definitions, or failing that, a measure that will show that that system is not trustworthy, something along those lines. So basically, if the trust is a value proposition and the trust is workable, then they get a surety under our definition of what trust means. If it is not workable, then we are measuring that and we can only assume that there is, as a response from the review teams chewing through this data later on, will be some recommendations. I think that's all we can say to him on that question. Regarding the second part where he uses the example and brings in the registrars, I think we need to be really, really specific that what we say we can do is what we've done in this conversation here today, and that is look at how we can better capture metrics going on in the new GTLD world that will measure whether or not this trust value proposition is working at the registrar level. I don't think if we're not really specific, we'll get into the murky areas of how happy people are with their registrars, and that I would like to keep well and truly away from. That's where we're going to get apples and oranges. And disappointed and frustrated consumers have a habit of bringing the whole bag of stuff to the table instead of working which is the table for sushi and which is the table for soup.
Well, and Cheryl, this is Jonathan Zook again for the transcript. Briefly, Barry, Paul Redmond is the new hire over there in compliance, would be the perfect person to get onto a
Great.
Call with us to discuss specific data capture and report
Perfect.
Requirements
Right.
For compliance. Paul Redmond is the person they just hired for that. Cheryl, I guess the point that you also inspired, though, is that ultimately the new GTLD program has a goal to actually overall increase competition choice and consumer trust. And so it could be that we don't always need to be making a distinction about whether or not there's more trust in the new TLDs than there is in the old ones, but that whether or not there's some delta in the overall level of complaints and things like that might be an interesting statistic that is a
yep.
function in theory of more competition requiring people to be better contracted parties overall because there's more new entrants, et cetera. I mean, that's part
and
of the idea
choice.
Behind this. It might be interesting to track the results overall as well.
Absolutely.
Whether or not the complaints as a percentage or something like that have gone up or down generally and not even just in old or new TLDs, but overall as a result of the new choice and competition that was brought about by the program, right?
And
Cheryl and Jonathan.
Jonathan, Cheryl here, there's a great big tick from me on everything you just said.
And yet, Cheryl, you were cautioning us as to setting targets for complaints. And on the other hand, you were ticking off the idea that we be sure that the systems that are designed in compliance can capture the data necessary to assess satisfaction.
Yep.
And those are not inconsistent, but they're not the same thing. If compliance is building a system that can categorize properly, we can encourage them to do that. But our mission was not only to define these phrases, but to set three-year targets. So we can elect to help define that they ought to capture in their complaint system the following four fields. We can elect whether or not to also set a target, comparing the new GTLD space to the legacy space, for instance, one no greater than the other. Another target is the number of complaints per number of 1,000 registrations would be lower in the new space than it is in the old, or that it would drop over time. So our decision to endorse the capture of data is separate from our recommendation that ICANN set a target.
That's right.
So clarify for me, Cheryl, were you suggesting that we not have targets in areas like registrar and registry complaints?
No, I was suggesting that when we do set targets for registrar and registry complaints, that they are clearly relating only to the aspects that we want them to in terms of what our mandate is. I don't want to get the complaint that they don't have it. They don't have their. They have. All right. Let me use a silly example for you. I don't want the complaint that comes from the organisation that's all about visually impaired. Right. That the font size online of the contract details is too small, getting mixed up with these metrics. Do you see what I mean?
And that might be unavoidable if we simply counted the number of complaints that came in.
Exactly.
And they happen to have a lot more complaints about the new TLDs than the old.
And we're heading into a multi-script world. And if the the Farsi or the Swahili script people think that the dot's in the wrong place or whatever, you know what I mean? We need to be aware.
Cheryl, if we observe that whatever the nature of the complaint, if there were more complaints per 1,000 registrations in the new space than in the legacy space,
that would be bad.
Well, I think so. I think that's something we can assess, the rate of complaints in the new versus the old, without even caring what the nature of it was, because some of it could have been folks who were worried about small fonts.
Mm.
So there are many times that this group has set a three-year target to say that 3 years out, X in the new TLDs should be better than X.
You're right.
In the legacy.
Okay, Steve, I'll retreat on this one, and I'll tell you why, because I hope I'm around in 3 or 4 years, and then I can argue for the non-parametric analysis that will need to be done on it.
All right, and I hope that Jonathan will make sure that we capture right data, because he's working as a client.
Exactly.
Capture the right data to know which parametric elements you need. Okay? Okay, so it's new versus legacy is really all we're going to say, and we can't just be the raw quantity of complaints. It has to be a rate of complaints. So the denominator for registrations would be domains, I guess, in both cases. So the rate of complaints per registration in the new space compared to the rate of complaints per registration in the legacies. Is everybody on board with something like that?
Mm-hmm.
This is Michael. I had, while we were talking, gone on to take a look at the complaint form, which is actually posted I guess on internic.net.
That's right.
And at least the radio controls are fairly specific with the types of complaints that are being submitted. So while there's, I agree, both a bulk sort of how many complaints are there, which shows sort of a general, I think it looks like from this that even with the legacy domains, there is a tremendous breakdown that we could utilize to determine those complaints that have to do with trust versus other types of complaints in the system. And it's certainly something to look at both as it exists now and as you're all talking with the new system that they're developing. But it looks like it already exists, and they must have some record of the breakdowns of those, you know, historically that could be utilized, and perhaps some metrics could be composed. Perhaps it's a ratio of false address complaints as opposed to, you know, small type complaints, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. And we certainly don't want every, you know, port 40 complaint on a registrar messing it up either.
And this is Barry, and just to add to that, Michael, you're very right. There are specific categories that are identified on the form. I think the main issue with this, as I think I recall from Maggie Surratt and some of her previous presentations, is the integrity of the data. Jonathan pointed out that this is just an initial complaint system, and everything else is manual behind that. So if a user comes in and selects that it's a spam abuse issue that they want to complain about, and it really turned out that it was a registrar customer service issue, I don't believe that there was a process in place with past complaints that they would go and change the category of that. So the integrity of the data is probably hit or miss. Not to say that it can't be done, but integrity is the issue.
Well, which may not have a great effect insofar as the measure that we're making, I don't think, is the actual number of complaints correctly placed, but the number of consumer complaints based on their experience, which, since we're looking at consumer trust, consumer choice, whichever, that's really the measure. Even if it's an incorrect, you know, placement, if they're making the same incorrect, you know, choices at this superficial level, we're not looking, I don't think, to make any empirical decisions to correct particular types of problems, but merely to take a measure of the effect of rolling out the new GTLDs as perceived by consumers. So, yeah, I think, you know, if we wanted to be specific, we would have to go to that second level. But certainly if we're measuring the same confusion among consumers, whether this is fishing or farming, we're going to have the same confused consumers in both sets. So it's still a valid measure.
That argues for, Michael, this is Steve. So I think you're agreeing we do want to measure the relative rate of complaint incidents, both at the registrar and registry level, and compare the new to the legacy GTLD. You're pointing out that the subtleties that will be missed by such a raw measure, but you're still supporting the idea of having those two new metrics and targets.
Correct. Yes.
Great.
Sorry.
All right, let's move on to the next one. Anything else on that? The next one was Andrew Mack, who does a lot of, this is Costa Rica, under consumer choice now. For Andrew Mack asked about outreach program. We don't have any metrics in there to say, did ICANN's outreach program work? The discussion there involved partly answers that those of us gave up front. Jonathan Zook weighed in, and in fact, deflected the question over to Bruce Tonkin. And the discussion focused on the notion of what outreach would be. There's certainly one outreach that happened over the past year, and that was the outreach of ICANN to tell potential applicants that they could apply for a new TLD. And that outreach program, I guess that will be judged by virtue of whether applicants knew about it and got their application in over the next 2 weeks. It'll all be over. So 3 years out, measuring outreach 3 years out, and awareness for applicants strikes me as an idle venture. On the other hand, the other outreach is to tell registrants, and they're picking their TLD, did the registrants have an awareness that there were lots of new choices 3 years out? So rather than invent a new metric, I looked into our table under consumer choice. In the third row in our table of consumer choice is a survey.
Yeah.
And that survey can simply be asked. It's a survey of registrants and users to assess the clarity in terms of the GTLD registry benefits and restrictions. That same survey might the question number one on that survey might be, were you aware that ICANN had launched and permitted new TLDs in 2012-2013, and use that data to support a question of whether our outreach program had been sufficiently informative. And having said all that, I'll just close by saying that if I applied for, whether I got applicant support or not, if I applied for a new TLD and I was running it in 2015, you know what? It strikes me that the outreach to potential registrants and users is my job, not ICANN's. If I have launched .bicycle or bicicletta in Italian, I would be the one spending money to get bike shops to register and to direct traffic to my web to my users. I don't think that's ICANN's job. So it doesn't measure ICANN, but it does measure whether the program was sufficiently communicated to generate awareness. So my bottom line conclusion is we just add a question to the survey on user and registrant awareness of the new TLDs under survey number 3 under consumer choice. Take a cue on that.
Cheryl here, big green tick from me.
Great. All right, our next one is on metrics. Now, Chuck Gomes brought up the question on metrics, and we knew this would happen. In fact, Michael Graham asked me about it in Costa Rica, where we came up with this idea of equating sunrise registrations to defensive registrations. And everybody knows that it's not a perfect analogy, not a perfect indicator of defensive registrations, and we acknowledge that right from the get-go. And it will provide false positives, and it will have false negatives. And I think our goal at doing so, and we're going to have to deal with this. This may be the single largest category of work we'll do, refining our draft advice for the next round, is to clarify what we mean by trying to assess registrations that were done for defensive purposes versus non-defensive. And you guys will have a chance to look in the transcript. We're all the way down to page
36, says Barry.
Thank you. 36, page 36 of the transcript before we get into discussion. Now, Chuck is with the registries. He's with VeriSign. So the registries did submit a detailed set of comments, and they did get into this a little bit more detail. The question for this group is, do we need to discuss further the need for us to qualify that defensive registrations and sunrise registrations are just rough approximations? They're not meant to be precise. Take a cue.
Hey, Steve, I'm sorry, it's Michael. I don't understand like the question that you're asking specifically.
Thanks, Michael. And I know that INTA was really keenly interested in this notion of defensive registrations. And in your instance, INTA believes that sunrise is an inadequate measure for defensive. Chuck Gomes thought that it was a overcounting of defensive registrations as a percentage of total. For instance, Chuck Gomes had said that if a registrant picks up an IDN version of their domain name in an IDN version of .com, then that brand didn't register for defensive purposes. They registered to gain use and traffic from users and registrants in that new IDN script. So a trademark owner can step into the sunrise period and do things that are sometimes defensive and sometimes genuinely creating new choices.
Yes.
For users. How do we make that distinction, Michael?
Right, well, that is, in fact, Michael again. That is something that we discussed, and the great concern is the fact that trademark owners will register in the sunrise period, regardless of whether it's a purely defensive or purely new site type of use, and they will do so because that is a safe time for them to get their trademark registered. And so just having that blank, whether or not it's registered during the sunrise period, really does not reflect whether or not it was a defensive or, split the word, offensive registration of that particular domain name. One thing that we looked at, and I believe it's in our comments, I don't have them right here, is to look at what happens, and this would require something more than just a mere measurement, what happens with those sunrise period registered domains. Do these simply resolve to an existing domain or website, or do they resolve to a new website, or are they a blank wall?
And Michael, just to quickly interrupt, you realize that is, in fact, the third row under choice. We started with the gross measure of sunrise over total, but then we very quickly transitioned to say, do a detailed look at how it resolves.
Yes,
Michael, I'm speaking of the third row down. I think you guys in your INTA comments noted that as well. And that leaves me wondering whether you are arguing that we should get rid of that gross top-line measure of sunrise divided by total, simply wait 3 years and look at the redirects. I'll wait for your answer.
Yeah, I'm trying to take a look to find. This is under the consumer choice chart?
Exactly, Michael. The first row just is a gross snapshot of the zone at the end of sunrise, and then 3 years out, take a look at the zone, .bank, .bike, .shop, and say in .shop, it turns out that 85% of the registrations in .shop 3 years out were ones that were made during sunrise. So that meant that trademark owners, because they're the only ones who can do shit during sunrise, so trademark owners were by far the dominant number of registrants in .shop. And we think that is an indication that it didn't create lots of new choices, because we argue that people that are in the Trademark Clearinghouse database and eligible for sunrise almost universally already have a domain name registered on another TLD. And you at INTA would be able to validate that. Is it true that to get in the Trademark Clearinghouse, it's almost certain you already have a domain name somewhere else? Mm-hmm. Have an answer for that?
Not definitive. I would imagine that certainly a vast majority of people going into the clearinghouse will have some sort of domain name out there.
Does anyone on the call, staff or otherwise, have an insight into that one?
Nope.
And you're looking at, I'm just trying to be clear, Steve, you're looking at the measure that reads survey a sample of duplicate registrations?
That's right, Michael. That's the third row, and the second row above it, where they had the same domain name in a legacy TLD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the second, third row on page 10 to start to get to this notion of how it was used, not
right.
Just who did it and when. You bring up a great point that the sunrise is a good opportunity for a trademark owner in the clearinghouse to go ahead and grab their domain name. It's a no-drama way. There might even be special pricing. Who knows? So you make a great point about that. So I hate for people to get too focused on our first row and worry that it overcounts and undercounts, when, in fact, our second and third rows on page 10 get to the notion of how it's used. Which was, I think, your point all along.
Yeah, I think that is it.
Cheryl,
I want to take a
Cheryl,
look. I mean,
first.
I think we looked at this in INTA, and you'll note that in our response we had a note that it removes this. And in some of these cases, allowing what we might believe were incorrect figures for really testing would cut both ways in reflecting whether or not the some the program was successful. In this, the only question that I would have, and I'm looking at this with a fresh eye, is these duplicate, the fact that there are duplicates, I suppose would be reflective of, even though the trademark owner has both of these domains, SLDs in both of these domains, and even though they are actively searching for it, consumers to use those, the fact that they are duplicate sites, and I guess that would be duplicate sites, not only that they're present there, but it's the same site in the two places, which would require some sort of review of them, beyond just measuring the fact that if they were just duplicates, then having the new domain obviously does not increase the choice. It's just duplicating it.
That is exactly what we were saying, is that that was probably not indicative of the registrant exercising a beneficial choice. They simply had to do a registration by necessity to stop someone else from getting it, not to gain traffic. So I think that INTA supports that sentiment, but where we were headed, even if I think when I looked at your table comments, folks, the INTA comments had two parts. They had a few pages of text, but you must also read their table. They took our actual measures table and attached notes and edits to it.
Right, and the note on this was, this would appear to remove from computation information regarding registrants that have a policy of cross-registration of domain names and trademarks. Again, identifying who would have that policy, would be a whole other level of analysis that would make it very difficult.
I'll bet staff is glad to hear you say that, because they'd rather not have to go that far. So when we come up with very high-level measures like this, we realize they are imperfect. They could overcount or undercount.
Right.
And to be conservative, then, we don't want to set really aggressive targets. Because if we use a rough measure, we should have a generous three-year target so that we don't end up being overcritical of the new DTLD program. And I think the INTA comments on this one are that, with respect to Sunrise, you thought that the percentage change should be considered indicative of a degree of success. But I think you're agreeing with us that the 85% of post-Sunrise does make sense. You are saying that proxy and privacy registrations should be counted, because whether it's Coca-Cola or a bank, when they do registration, sometimes they may do proxy and privacy. And if they
Correct.
Did it in the old legacy TLDs, they'll do it in the new, and it probably isn't necessary to count them, to discount them.
Right. That was our feeling with that.
Right. So you see where it gets us into trouble is the third row, was we were going to look at duplicate registrations in new TLDs and then try to determine from the WHOIS data where the registrant is still maintaining the same domain name in a legacy GTLD. And if we were to use WHOIS data for that, then proxies and privacies wouldn't help us. But if we do an online survey, we won't use WHOIS data. And I'm speaking of the third row on page 10 under consumer choice.
Well, I mean, what is the likelihood that the same – I would think it would be likely that the same people who are using privacy or proxy in the one would do so in the other if it's available.
Right, but that means we can't walk down the WHOIS tree to determine if it's really the same registrant.
They just get culled from the data set, Cheryl here.
Cheryl, you're exactly right. We had thought we were just going to dump them out and not even look at the proxy and privacies, and that was what we put in our draft advice. And INTA was asking us, don't dump those records.
Yep. I maintain we have to dump those records, and that's just tough.
And Michael, what's your response to that from INTA?
Well, at this point, I mean, we felt that they should be in there because that doesn't affect the existence of these sites. If what you're saying is that not only would these references be dropped, but they would be dropped on both ends so that any analysis would exclude those entirely, then that might be a different point that I could go back and see if that would satisfy it. Again, since we're not looking at specifics, we're looking at at the generalities of this.
Yep. It's trained.
But I think the concern would be that we would be dropping this, and somehow that would also affect the analysis.
Yeah, the first row on page 10, we don't actually compare it to the legacy space. It's a very raw general measure that says very, very Cobb and staff would take a snapshot of the zone for a given TLD on the day their sunrise ended, and they'd have a number, and that number would be the quantity of registrations that happened during sunrise. Let's call it 10,000. And then 3 years later, how many registrations are in the zone? Answer, 100,000. Well, in that case, it well exceeded the target, which was to say that 85%, our target, 85% of the registrations would have occurred post-sunrise. Because 90,000 out of 100,000 occurred post-sunrise, so clearly it wasn't just trademark owners rushing in there to get additional domain names. The vast majority of registrations were not in the Trademark Clearinghouse database, not running into the sunrise period. Now, I realize that trademark owners may not jump into sunrise. They may just wait. And if they feel the need later on for defensive purposes or offensive purposes, then they would register. So I realize not all trademark owners will rush into sunrise.
Right. Let me take back the question on privacy and proxy and also the point that you were making about dropping that. And the reason for that would be that it cannot be cross-checked
right on
the other side.
Yep.
That's kind of the need, but we don't cross-check on the first row. But it turns out that when you really examine this hard, it may be that we could count them on row one, which is the sunrise divided by total, because it probably doesn't matter. If Coca-Cola and a bunch of trademark owners use privacy and proxy registrations, there's still guys who register during the sunrise. I guess it really doesn't matter.
It matters less.
It matters less, right, Cheryl? I mean, so I could say that INTA has a very good point crossing out the do not count proxy and privacy on the first row.
Well, and actually, now that I think of it, I mean, in order to participate in Sunrise, you're going to be in the TMCH. I do not know how deep the information is going to be public in terms of ownership, but it seems to me that it will be extremely difficult to participate in Sunrise, for which you must have both a TMCH actualization and verification, so actual use, and not identify yourself. It may be an entire non-issue according to, well, we don't know what TMCH is going to be set up to reveal at this point. But do you see what I'm talking about? I mean, it may be a non-issue.
I do. And then with respect to row two on choice said that we were going to measure the relative share of registrations that already had the very same domain name, left of the dot, in a legacy TLD. And for that measure, we said we would count all registrations that redirect to a domain in the legacy TLD. So delbianco.bicycle or delbianco.shop was already present in delbianco.com. So the delbianco.shop registration record simply redirected to the delbianco.com record. And if that were true, we were concluding that is a redirected registration. And that if redirected registrations were more than 15% of all registrations in a new space, that we thought that was an indication that they were defensive, that they didn't create as much new choice as we ought to. And I, now that I think of it, Barry, I really need your help on this because you were part of the conversation on proxy and privacy. I don't know that proxy and privacy matter at all at determining if it's a redirect. Cheryl, your hand is up on this?
My hand was up earlier, but I agree. I don't think it matters at all if it's on a redirect. I did want to actually address redirect, though, and I am channeling Chuck here. Redirects certainly do not mean that it's defensive, and it, in fact, can be argued that in a percentage of the cases, it may actually result in new choice, because I... for whatever reason, as a consumer, may feel more comfortable in going to Bianco.shop than I would in DelBianco.com, because for some reason I have a different trust value in a new GTLD.shop than I do in the .com that was the legacy. That said, we can't tease those out easily with this lot of metrics measures. We would actually have to have different types of analysis, and we'd have to go searching for particular types of data sets, which would involve probably the more expensive options of a specifically targeted survey. That's not our job at this point in time. And I think the sort of the bucket measures that we're using, like greater than 15% or less than 15%, are okay for where we are now, or where we need to be in 3 years' time. I think
and,
we're good.
And we set the bar rather low, right?
Yeah,
you said that the target was to have at least no more than 15% redirected 3 years out.
Yeah.
My question for the group would be, why did we care about Whois records at figuring out redirects? Anybody recall why privacy and proxy and Whois data are necessary to do the second row on page 10?
This is Barry. I'm pulling off the top of my head, but I almost think that it was just a carryover from the first row, and that it just seemed to make sense when we were putting this together. So, you know, transaction A, coke.pop redirects to coke.com, and that's a privacy registration. You can conclude, or it's registered under privacy proxy. You can conclude that if it's redirecting to coke.com, that Coca-Cola Corporation owns coke.pop. But if coke.pop resolved to pepsi.com and it was privacy proxy and we excluded that, then, you know, that's probably a clear case of cyber squatting in many sense.
Yeah, and there's other ways that the trademark owner would have pursued that. Yeah, Barry, I mean, I hope that we can attack this by looking back at the transcripts of our earlier calls, but I'm guessing that the privacy proxy stuff we have on page 10 is obsolete. We fixed it ourselves by doing a survey in the third row. We fixed it ourselves by measuring redirects, by looking at zone data alone without Whois. And we don't really care if during sunrise you happen to use a privacy proxy.
Yep.
My guess is that we'll end up stripping that stuff out of there. I'd love to hear what Cheryl thinks of that.
Well, you know what I think of having dirty data. If it can't be verified, it can't be used.
Okay, so this was a fortunate segue because it enabled us to jump into the INTA comments a little bit. And with everyone's indulgence, I'd like to ask Michael, since we have him on this call, a couple of questions about the INTA in the 15 minutes we have left.
And I will try to answer them, and I'll defer them if I can't, and talk with the folks next week in Washington.
You're allowed to take them on notice, Michael. We're not
Thank
mean.
You. Right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Michael, so real quickly, on page 2 of your written comments, you get to the notion of finding sites that people are seeking and wanting to have a metric that measures the accuracy of search engine results. So the question for you is, what kind of objective ways is there to know whether people are finding what they're looking for and whether that's a trustworthy domain versus non-trustworthy? This is bottom of your page 2 in your text.
Right. Search engine analysis should include an analysis of the accuracy of search engine results both before and after the new GTLDs, that section?
That's right.
You have asked the question which we asked ourselves, whether or not there would be an objective means of determining that. And I am not aware of one. I'm not a software engineer. I've not taken this in front of our people who do software and online software engineering. It may be that would be subjective determination or a survey.
Let me ask you to do this then, since there's another few days for reply comments. Let's say that you go back to INTA and say, if we can, let's suggest either objective measures or suggest a survey with respect to search engine accuracy. Instead of leaving it to the working group, of which you're part, leaving it to the working group to just conclude we can't find any, use the 6 days that remain to see if you can suggest one.
Okay.
Otherwise, you know what will happen. This one, we won't be able to do anything with it. The same is true on the top of page 3 of your comments, where you discuss the quality of competition, not just the quantity of competition measures.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't have it up, the INTA said that the proper focus for competition is more than just an increase in the quantity of domain names and registries. The quality of competition resulting from the new GTLD should also be taken into consideration. For example, there should be an analysis of the number of dead links and redirects of second-level domain names in newly delegated TLDs. And that would be an indication of quality.
Right, yeah, I was going to say, at least in that point, that would be one suggested objective measure.
And I would ask you then, in the reply comments, to say whether you were going to offer a measure, 14%, 45%,
yeah.
Or would you relatively measure it to the legacy GTLD space? So all the new GTLDs have 18% dead links 3 years out, against the legacy GTLDs, which only had 12%. And we'd say that the new GTLDs are not doing as well, a lower quality. So I would invite INTA to clarify whether it's a measure of over time or a measure of comparison to the legacy GTLDs.
Okay.
Since it looks like we'll probably already measure redirects in the conversation we just finished, dead links would be another thing to measure.
Easy enough.
Question for the team. Do we have dead links anywhere in our current table?
Not from memory, Geraldine.
Yeah, this was.
I don't think so, Cheryl. So, Barry, let's make a note of that. Are dead links something that are easy to ascertain by looking through a zone file?
Okay. Negative. I don't think so.
No, I don't think it is.
It's something where you have to design a computer program that walks the zone and tries to do a resolution request.
And they're if not it hard.
404, do we call that a dead link? It requires walking the zone. A computer would do it, not a human.
No, this is Barry. That's a does not resolve versus a dead link.
What's the difference?
It can be a non-resolve.
When I hear dead link, it's a page on a resolved website that has links that point to nowhere.
Correct.
Michael, is that what you meant by dead link in the INTA comment?
I do not believe that is what we meant.
Okay. Michael, let me throw it back to you then. To clarify what dead links are, right down to the error code that comes back or the conditions.
Right. My understanding, and I will confirm this, is that it would be a 404. It would be a does not resolve.
Cheryl here.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
That is an important definition, because there are a whole lot of temporary and less temporary reasons for a 404.
Okay. Expand on that, please.
And it would skew your data really badly, depending on when you took it.
3 years out, it's 3 years that the GTLD has been up, but it's still relatively young if you're a brand new registrant and you just opened your business, right? You still might be a 404 because you registered, but you haven't got it up yet.
Yeah. Can I just reply? I actually think the measure is valuable. I'm happy to have it in the metrics. I'd be really interested to have someone else try and be specific on what the definition of a dead link is, because I certainly was thinking as Barry defined, not as a 404. But then I'd probably have a slightly biased view on that. But
Cheryl, could you and Barry explain once again, if it's not a 404... And I went to langdonor.bank. How would I know if it was a dead link under your definition?
Because when you went to langdonor.bank and you looked for my family photos, the link to my family photos have been removed. it no longer exists. There are pages which refer to that child page, and that child page no longer exists at all.
Right, and I understand the terminology of that, and as I say, I do not believe that that's what we were trying to get across, but I'll confirm that, because actually, I mean, if you're linking into a site to begin with, then the primary measurement that we're looking at exists, obviously. Right, you're resolving. So I will confirm that, and I will also go back with the question of if someone can come up with a means of measurement.
And you know, Cheryl, here again, you know why it's important? Because when you set out the requirements for whoever designs or even just buying it off the shelf or using it off the shelf for the crawler that does these link set tests, those parameters need to be clearly defined. You can look for either.
Right.
But it's important to know which one you're looking for. And if you're doing a dead link measure, you can find dead links on really live, active, and consumer choice used and trusted sites.
Right.
Okay. Now, regardless of when we get these metrics, what would be, in my totally biased view, the valuable measure would be, and I'd love to hear, as Steve invited NTA to put in its suggestions on this, I think what would be interesting is comparing the legacy to the new, not a percentage factor. Because then you've got a clearer measure of what new GTLDs have offered consumers.
And you're talking simply about a raw number?
Yeah. One is greater or lesser than the legacy.
Yeah, Michael, you'll see that our group was really disciplined about our targets to say were they 3 years out relative to the legacy space or relative to the baseline 3 years ago, or, you know, changing over time, things like that.
Right. Well, and I guess, and I think the type of mindset, at least that I had in going through this analysis with INTA, and I will admit to frequent headaches while we were talking about this, having left math behind me years ago, was I kept coming back to there is a ratio, but it's not a ratio of legacy to new. It's a ratio within legacy compared to the ratio within the new. So I think what you were getting at, Charlotte, was the number of or the ratio of, I'll use dead links for lack of a better term, dead links to active sites in legacy versus dead links to active sites in the new. And
correct.
That percentage or that ratio should decrease if we are offering a greater quality overall. That
it can be argued that that is the case, yes.
Okay. I think, yeah. And I think I agree with that analysis. I mean, there can't be a percentage change. I think that even in those, and you will see in some of our comments in the charts, we struggled at some of those in looking at them and saying, this looks high, this looks low, and trying to make a suggestion of what we believed would be more accurate. There are a couple of those, and I believe the one in when we were talking about consumer choice in the second row where we suggested going from 15 to somewhere between 3 and 9, and that figure and a couple others that we put in there actually were derived from the second economic study.
Mike, I'm going to have to cut it off there. We only have a minute or 5 minutes left, and we do want to wrap up and plan for our next call. But I appreciate you taking it on board some of these questions, because it's an opportunity for INTA to come in with a reply comment.
Yes, I will go back and chat with them on those two big points that we discussed.
I'll give you one more to think about. It's on page 4 where you talk about the percentage of IDNs in each script, and you're suggesting they ought to converge to the same percentage of people who use that script or language. I did the math on that, and I can't make it work, so I would ask if you could expand examples for the percentage convergence of IDN to populations at the top of page 4.
Okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. The only other thing that was major, and I'll just leave this on the table for later, and that was the consideration of a snapshot, a 1 year, and the 3 year.
We agree that wherever possible, if it's not too expensive, things that are 3 year targets ought to be measured at 1 and 2 years as well.
Okay.
We all agree with that. In fact, we probed the board about why they came up with the number 3, because 3 is sort of after the affirmation review team is practically done, and it doesn't really coincide well to the work they have to do. And
so that suggestion would actually be part of the written proposal then,
definitely.
Or suggestion.
It definitely would be, but we do have to be cognizant of cost. I mean,
right.
if Barry writes a program that can walk a zone and get an answer,
mm-hmm.
that's one thing. But if there has to be a survey conducted, and surveys are $100,000 a pop, it's really going to be difficult to argue for doing it 3 times for each one of our measures instead of just once.
Well, I think we discussed that quickly as well when I brought out how much it would cost, and the suggestion from INTA was one big survey, to the extent that that's possible. But I didn't go back to see if we covered the same people.
Great. Barry, tell us about what our calendar is like for the next call.
Thanks, Steve. This is Barry. For the next call, what we have on the agenda, of course, the reply period closes next Monday. As soon as that closes, I'll be incorporating all the comments into a summary, the deliverable out of that will be a spreadsheet that contains who made the comment, the primary components of the comments submitted that are up for discussion for the working group, and then an action column. Of course, the comments from the Costa Rica session will be appended to the bottom of this. And basically, until the working group has all agreed that the comments have been addressed appropriately and we identify what changes will occur to the draft advice letter, that'll be our course of operation until we satisfy all that and have created the final draft letter. So for specific milestone schedule, we've got a meeting on the 15th of May. And
Barry, could you stop there for a second? Do you believe that staff will be able to summarize the comments as of May 7th so that they'd be available to us in advance of the call on the 15th?
I will do my best. It will, when we look at the calendar, I should be able to have it done by the Thursday before the end of that week. So the 10th or the 11th, I'll have the summary produced, and then the working group members can review it through the weekend and the 14th.
Thank you. One other question. Has staff started to do that summary on the comments that have already been submitted?
No.
And if there were staff capacity to do so, it would make it faster, so that you would only have to analyze the ones that came in on the 5th, 6th, and 7th. Making it more likely that we had a summary in hand before the 15th. But I realize that's subject to resources available.
Correct. But to be perfectly honest, we have the 29th of May basically to construct the next draft advice letter. I'm assuming that session will also be used to continue negotiating all of the summary comments, given it's taken us 2 full sessions just to go through the Costa Rica comments. I imagine that both the next 2 meetings will be doing the same for the public comments.
So I would ask the group whether you believe a call on the 21st of May should be at least temporarily put on the agenda.
Yes.
Any other few
I'm
views
sure
on
over
that?
The yes.
Barry, we don't have too many left on the call, so let's say that a supermajority of Cheryl and Steve said we should put...
Cheryl and Steve agree.
put another calendar item for the 21st of May. I mean, I'd rather do a call for an hour and a half on the 21st of May than a 4-hour call on the 29th.
Agree. I'll get that thrown onto the schedule.
And so staff does a lot of summaries. We end up doing a discussion, and then different members of our working group take up the pen and propose edits to the document like we did first time around. So I suppose that it's the working group that would do the document edits, and the working group that would come to consensus on document edits, as you say here, by the 29th of May.
Correct.
Last question, Barry. Do you believe that the extended application window has any effect at all on our work?
Unobjectively, I will say that given the current timeline with the close of the TAS window, that does probably affect the end result of when the first GTLD gets delegated by X duration. So thus, that would definitely push out when the future AOC review team gets started. But with respect to the here and now, I don't see that being any kind of conflict, regardless of what may go on in the PROG session.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Barry. Agree with that.
Barry,
any other business then for this?
Zook, are you going to reach out to Paul Redmond about maybe participating directly on one of the next couple of calls?
Yes, definitely.
Anybody else have anything for the good of the order here?
The only thing, Cheryl, here for the record, just on the 12 June submit to GNSR Council, is it then for the Council to redirect to the other SO and ACs? Because I'm very concerned about getting it on the agendas of the other SO and ACs in the Prague meeting. For example,
Steve,
I think... Steve,
with an answer on that, I would hate for Council to hold up by one minute whether or not the advice would be looked at by ALAC. So I would at least argue that the minute we finish our working group, that is public document, and it would be available for consideration not just by the GNSO who asked for it, but by the GAC, ALAC, and CCNSO.
Yeah.
That would be my opinion.
Because that's pretty much a drop-dead date, I would think, for all of us. But I would suggest that the leadership of this work group needs to make that a clear and agreed-to conversation with the GNSO Council.
Great. No further insights. We'll call it a day. Thanks, everyone, for a very meaty call.
That was excellent. Thank you.
Great. Right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for letting me participate.
You bet.
No,
thank you. Everybody. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tanya.